when along that process does someone go from an accuser to a victim?
So you cannot discount the possibility of a false allegation.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case, Worst Case Scenario. I'm your host, Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor, and with me in the studio is...
Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds.
Jim, it's great to be back in the studio together.
Absolutely.
And I love talking about crime with you, and I'm very excited to continue to talk about, let's just call it a contentious issue.
Yeah, definitely. It's causing a lot of people to get upset, and what's unfortunate about that is I have no problem with people disagreeing or arguing vehemently about whatever they believe, but I do have a problem with them attacking you or attacking me. And in particular, I have a problem with them attacking our credentials and our careers, or minimizing it, actually, and not understanding the contextual basis that we're coming from, because we are not only both attorneys, not only both former prosecutors, I'm also a former FBI agent and investigator, and we are both expert witnesses in this field of sexual assault.
Yeah.
And so we have a much higher standard than the average person in terms of forming opinions and expressing our opinions about this topic. And so when people say, how could you possibly not believe every victim? Well, we do believe every victim. Every victim. Every victim of a crime. However, we don't know if a crime was committed in the instances that have been reported about Brett Kavanaugh. We are now getting more and more information. The first big piece of information that we got was the actual letter from Dr. Ford.
Yeah, before we get into that, though, I would also like to say, as you did, that we certainly do not mind people having differing opinions. You and I argue all the time.
I know.
People on this podcast have heard us do it, and people have said things like, I don't think Jim likes Francie very much. Funny, it's never the other way around. But we argue all the time. We disagree on a lot of topics, you and I, and we're still respectful about it, yeah. And we appreciate each other's opinions.
And we fall on opposite ends of a lot of the political spectrum, and we are very different people with different, very different perspectives. But we do respect each other, and even though you pick on me mercilessly, I still care about you and listen to your opinion. And however wrong it is, most of the time, I still let you,
you let me talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. People are calling us rape apologists, victim shamers. They accuse me of contributing to rape culture. They said we were victim blaming. All those insults have no place here in this debate, which
that's
is a very
absolutely
serious matter.
Garbage. That, and that really pisses me off. Them calling you that. I mean, I can take it. I know people say similar stuff about me, but it's just, I can see, I know what your career was. I know your position, the first congressional appointee to shepherd child victims through the legal process to make sure they were protected in the United States of America. That's you. I mean, it's outrageous to say that you're, a rape apologist. No. What we did was distinguish between the allegations made by Dr. Ford and rapists, because she made no allegations of rape. She said she thought that he might have, under other circumstances, tried to rape her. She didn't even say that. She said she might have been raped under other circumstances. And so that's a very different thing. And in fact, when I described it, what she claimed happened as groping, I was attacked for minimizing this attempted rape or this sexual assault. Well, in fact, now in her own statement, in her own opening statement, in her own words, she said she was groped and that he tried to take her clothes off.
That's right.
That is not rape.
No.
You can call it what you want, but you, Francie and I can't.
No.
We have to stick to what the law is. And that's all we did.
Well, and that's our training, Jim. And people are trying to argue that, well, this is a Supreme Court appointment. This isn't a court of law. I think people have just not listened to what we've been saying for over a year. And that is, we are trained law enforcement professionals, and we look at crime and cases with an eye based on our training and experience. Right. And that is criminal training and experience. Of course we're going to look at it through that lens.
But also, you have to understand that this may be a judicial appointment, but the allegations are of crimes.
That's right.
And we are actually here to give you our perspective on that. And as differing as Francie and my opinions are on things, the way we look at cases is similar. We have to go through what the law says, and we have to decide whether it meets the thresholds of each one of these crimes that have been alleged.
And to me, even though Brett Kavanaugh may not face criminal prosecution, he is certainly being called a rapist, being called a sex offender, being labeled a sexual predator, which is has serious consequences in this society for him as a man, as a father, as a husband, and as a judge. And so I am not willing to label people sex offenders.
Nobody should be.
We shouldn't be willing to do it until and unless a certain threshold of evidence has been provided. And what we provided last, or what was provided to us last week, was simply a letter. That's all we had to opine upon. And now we have a little more.
We have a lot more, actually, but we'll get to it. So let's talk for a minute about the word victim. And I will say that in my experience as a prosecutor, as an investigator for the FBI, a special agent and a supervisory special agent and a profiler, that up until one point in time, anybody who made an accusation against somebody of a crime was called the victim of a crime. And that happened when they reported it. That happened when they went through the police system, the FBI system, then through the court system, whether it's the local, state, or federal, the Justice Department, or a local or state court. Those people were always referred to as victims. And then one case happened. And that case was the case involving Michael Jackson. And because of his stature as a entertainer, loved by billions of people around the world, his lawyer had the weight to actually change that. And that lawyer very strategically started calling the victims of those crimes accusers. It was very subtle, just happened, and everybody just kind of accepted it. But that distinction, although true, is different. Somebody being an accuser in the general public anonymously or outside of the justice system, the justice process, somebody can make an accusation. I get that. But the person that Michael Jackson's lawyers called an accuser was actually the one who formed the basis for probable cause to arrest Michael Jackson. So I believe that's a step up. Once somebody gets arrested based on the information you provide, then at least law enforcement has vetted that. And when somebody gets indicted, then either a grand jury or a prosecutor has vetted that. And when somebody goes to trial, then you have the additional vetting of the court. And eventually, you have either an acquittal or a conviction. I would ask, when along that process does someone go from an accuser to a victim? When? Well, there's no rule book on that.
No.
But I would say that if someone has provided enough information, that a law enforcement agency believes it has risen to the level of probable cause, and then a prosecutor's office has reviewed that information and obtained an indictment, either through a grand jury or other means, because some don't use grand juries. And then if the case has gone through preliminary hearings and then gone to trial, that's another level. And I think all those levels actually are opportunities for the information to be vetted. And let me just tell you, one of the biggest issues here is that even after all that process and after convictions are won, there have been people, not extreme numbers, but there have been people who have taken it all the way through that process in sexual assault and rape cases, and then later admitted that they were lying the whole time. And even when they don't admit that, there have been certainly hundreds now false convictions that have been overturned in the system.
Yeah, that had eyewitness evidence, people saying that they witnessed the crime or knew the person did it.
Or that they were the victim of a
crime. That's right. That's right.
And so Emmett Till's, I believe, is a perfect example of that. And Emmett was killed because of a false allegation.
Yes.
But here's the thing. This is the context within which I operate. I don't only have the experience of reading what's in the newspaper or what I've gleaned from TV and movies and so forth, or books that I've read. I've been in law enforcement for over 30 years. I've been actively involved in investigations for many decades. And I spent 12 years at the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, far beyond any doctoral or postdoctoral course of study, far beyond what anybody could ever glean out of any university in this world. I spent that time studying and analyzing and consulting and investigating crimes, violent crimes and sexual crimes, crimes that fit squarely into the area that we're talking about now. And because of that, I have a body of knowledge, and my predecessors passed their knowledge on to me, and I passed it on to the people that followed me. And that's incredibly important to understand, because let me tell you about the very first case I ever brought to the Behavioral Analysis Unit. At the time, it was still the Behavioral Science Unit. It was a case of a person that was a relative of somebody that was very close to me, that came to me to complain about the fact that as a child, she was sexually victimized by her father, and that she then witnessed her father pick up hitchhikers and runaways and chain them up in their basement and kill them and chop their bodies up, and made her help him distribute the pieces of their bodies into the lake that was near their house.
What a horrific tale.
And that there was a 4-year-old boy who he abducted and killed in their basement, and he then dug up a portion of their basement and buried his body there. When she was telling me this story, she was literally curled up like a little ball, and we were actually in an FBI interview room, and every FBI interview room is also set up for interviews of suspects. So there's a bar anchored into the wall, incredibly secure, on the wall. And I just remember her curling up in a ball and holding onto that bar for dear life. And she seemed so small and timid, and she was recounting these details and crying. And she was so upset, and I felt so much for her. And I brought in my good friend and colleague, Jim Fitzgerald, and he also interviewed her. And then we brought the case down to the Behavioral Science Unit. And we presented it to them. And Jim opened up an FBI investigation into this case. The FBI spent months doing a comprehensive investigation. She was so convincing that Jim Fitzgerald actually went undercover posing as a limo driver and drove her up to meet her father and get him in the car and then engage him in conversations so that they could record it and see if they can get a confession out of him. And while they were driving him around, she confronted him about certain things, about these deaths and so forth. And he did kind of seem to be tacitly approving it. Like, almost, you know, why wouldn't you outrageously scream, no, I didn't do those kinds of things?
He wasn't denying it.
Not really. And afterwards, they took him into a room and interrogated him. And when they asked him these questions about the murders and so forth, he said, oh, my daughter has some serious problems, and I didn't want to upset her by contradicting what she was saying. But of course, I never did anything like that. That's ridiculous. And he said, go ahead, search the house, search the lake, whatever, do what you want. So guess what they did? They went and they used ground penetrating radar to check the basement. They didn't find anything, but they dug up the basement floor anyway.
And there should have been a body of a 4-year-old.
There was nothing there. They also went to the lake and they used sonar to search the bottom of the lake. And then they drained the entire lake. And then they dug up the sediment underneath the lake.
And they found lots of body parts.
No body parts.
No body parts. At all. Wow.
And when this was the result, I was just baffled because I believed her so much. She was so believable. And then Pete Smerick, one of my mentor profilers, came up to me and said, Jim, look, you know, I understand this is a very tough situation, but let me explain something to you. We've noticed a phenomenon in the 1980s where a number of women came forward. They were usually in their 30s or so, and they recounted very graphic details about their fathers or somebody else close to them who abducted and murdered kids or adults or prostitutes. And every one of them was investigated, and not a single one of them provided a single detail that ever corroborated what these women said.
Well, that makes no sense.
Well, it doesn't make any sense. It's you know, it sounds like it's, you know, a mass hallucination, right? But the theory, and of course, this is a theory. These are theories that were propounded by the people that were in the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, FBI profilers, people with degrees in psychology and related fields. And they said they felt that what most likely happened was that these women were sexually victimized by their father or this other person. And it probably went on for a long time. And the nature of incest being so horrific that they believed that their brains concocted a much more extreme story that they then internalized, because this made what they actually went through almost irrelevant.
It minimized it.
It wasn't anywhere near as bad as what they had in their brains about what their fathers were doing. And this was a very strange but instructive experience for me. I absolutely 100% believed this woman. Her body language, what she was saying, the details, all of that just made me believe it. And in fact, when we went to investigate, it turns out that there was a 4-year-old boy who went missing during the time period that she was a child, and that her father, along with other members of the community, were actually out searching for this boy, but his body was never found. Never found in that basement or anywhere else. And it just appears that that never happened. And yes, I'm sure, you know, there is a possibility that all of those people were actually killed, and he went back and somehow got to the bottom of the lake and found every piece of bone and removed it from the lake and removed the body from under the concrete, under his basement.
Yeah, highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. And so when we're evaluating the credibility of statements, I do have that in the back of my mind. But it's not just for female victims who come forward, or male victims who come forward, or old victims, or young victims. It's for everybody. It's the same standard.
Well, it has to be the same standard, regardless of what kind of crime is being alleged or who's alleging it. It has to be the same standard. That's what justice means.
Right. And when you're talking about perhaps not allowing a person to continue with his career, obviously somebody who has distinguished himself in his career, not allowing them to continue their career because of criminal allegations. Sorry, but we have to use the standard that we use to judge criminal allegations. And we can't just, at least you and I can, we can't just say, oh, well, for political reasons, I think this should happen. Well, you're a woman.
I am.
You know how difficult it is for women in this system or any other system. But you still apply that for every woman that comes in front of you, every girl that comes in front of you, every guy that comes in front of you,
always.
Every boy that comes in front of you.
Every person.
Every person. And that's the way you have to do it. It has to be dispassionate.
I can, you know, I never considered myself to be a truly dispassionate prosecutor in the sense that I was very passionate about prosecuting, especially crimes against children. But that doesn't mean that any child that came into my office merited my automatic belief. Even children that came to me had some kind of an investigation that had been done. So there were more generally than bare allegations. But even then, it was up to me as the prosecutor to test the evidence in the case, because that case was going to be tested in court by a judge, by a jury, by a defense attorney. So that was my job. And that's where I come to. I have seen more sexual assaults than any person that I know. I have seen more adult and child pornography than any person that I know. I spent a decade looking at millions and millions of images of young men and women, young boys and girls being sexually assaulted. I know what it looks like. I understand empathy. I have a tremendous amount of it. I have gone home many nights crying, not being able to process this, having no one to talk to, certainly not talking to my husband about it. I'm not traumatizing him with what I've just had to see. I still don't forget those images. Every time I talk about it or think about it, they sit in my head.
I know. Well, every child's face is in my head. Thing. And unfortunately, this is something that somebody has to do in order to protect those children. And we did it. We did it for decades.
That's right.
And we did it for decades, yes. And we suffered through it because we care about the victims. We care about actual victims of actual crimes. That's what we care about.
Yes.
And we know that there are some people who are victimized and you can't ever prove it.
No, that's
true. There are some people who are victimized in one way and you can never prove that, but you can prove something else. And we know that there are some people who downright lie about this thing.
Yes, there are.
There are some people that downright lie about sexual victimization. There are others who firmly believe what they're saying, but either their memory is wrong or they're confused or they have issues that make them believe. There are all those possibilities. There's a spectrum of different behaviors. We don't know where the people that are now making allegations against Judge Kavanaugh, where they land.
No. And, you know, Jim, we know, and it's been unpopular on our feed to say that sometimes people lie about being victimized by crime, a variety of crime. But that includes women who sometimes don't tell the truth about being sexually assaulted. Men sometimes don't tell the truth about being sexually assaulted. It's a small subset. We all agree with that. But it happens. It happened in the Duke LaCrosse case. It happened in the Rolling Stone article accusing almost an entire fraternity of the gang rape of one woman that nearly got everyone expelled, prosecuted, and that turned out to be flat out 100% made up. So you cannot discount the possibility of a false allegation when, like you and I are doing here, are assessing the credibility of allegations. And that is what we are doing. We are not calling Dr. Ford a liar. We'll get in later to this other woman that's come forward tonight, Julie Swetnick. But I'm not calling Dr. Ford a liar. We were merely last week assessing her credibility based on the evidence that we had. which is sometimes what you have as a prosecutor, people complaining, why didn't you just wait for more information? Well, we had no idea there'd be any more information. Well,
and secondly, everybody was already opining about it. You think we knew about it because we're just, you know, we're these, you know, mentalists and we just grabbed this information for the universe? The fact is, it was all over the news. Yeah. That's why we're talking about it. Biggest of course we're going to talk about it. And we were trying to arm people in the public with the tools to actually assess. So now we do have Dr. Ford's statement, her written statement, her original letter that went to the congressman.
Yes.
And there are a number of things in there that are indicators of credibility. Mm-hmm. There's time and spatial things and emotional components that indicate credibility. And then there are things that are just not there. And the fact is that the allegations that are made out by that letter, and now she has with her now opening statement for tomorrow's testimony, which is now public.
Yeah, which, by the way, we'll be releasing this on Friday, so it'll be after the testimony. So she released a public statement Wednesday night, which is when we're sitting here talking and recording.
Right.
And she will either read that or have it just submitted into the record at the hearing on Thursday.
Right. And in that, she adds some details that were missing from the letter and certainly clears up any question about whether or not she actually was making an allegation of rape or attempted rape. She does not say those words in this opening statement.
No, she does not.
She does not make out a case for it. She first says that he was groping her. He was laying on top of her, groping her, and trying to remove her clothing. That would be her outer clothing, by the way. And that he was grinding his hips against her. There was no mention of a penis. There was no mention of any genital parts on either person.
No.
So that's missing. And those are details that need to be asked by the person that's going to be questioning her and questioning Brett Kavanaugh.
Well, that's right. And she doesn't say anything about him grabbing her breasts or her buttocks or her vaginal area. These are, by the way, required elements in proving the crime of attempted rape or sexual assault of some kind. In order to be a sexual assault, you have to have touched, groped, or otherwise disturbed the sexual area of the victim. She doesn't ever say that. So again, Jim and I are trying to analyze this from a criminal perspective and whether or not in her statement, these allegations or this incident rises to the level of a crime. It might rise to the level of some kind of battery. It might rise to the level of some kind of false imprisonment or even an assault, which put her in fear of receiving some kind of bodily injury. But it does not, at this point, looking at all of her statements to me, like it was a sexual assault in the sense that it would be provable in court beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. The one thing I want to ask you, because obviously I know this varies from state to state by definition, but if she's saying he was grinding against her, grinding his hips against her, what does that amount to? Would that potentially be a sexual assault as well?
Maybe, but we need more detail than that. Where was he grinding his hips against her? It seems like it's obvious, but I don't know the answer because she doesn't provide that level of detail. And the prosecutor that's been retained by the Judiciary Committee is probably going to ask her that tomorrow. So hopefully we'll have more information.
And I know that people are bristling about why would she have to tell all these details? Well, let me tell you, not only have we had to interview children as young as 5 to get these details from them, and people as old as 80 to get these details from them, but I had to do it in my case. Every victim, every single victim who goes through the criminal justice system has to do that. It's part of the reason why I left from being a prosecutor, because I hated bringing children through that process in a cold, sterile, combative environment of a courtroom. I hated that process. When I was an investigator, when I was an FBI agent, I could control the circumstances so that they weren't sort of re-victimized by the system. But once it got to court, it was out of my hands. And so to me, I felt much, much more comfortable being on the investigation side than I did putting a child on the stand. And what I hoped to accomplish, and what all of my FBI colleagues who worked sexual crimes and crimes against children hoped to accomplish, was to build enough of a case so that the defendant would plead guilty and I wouldn't have to put any victims on the stand. So if we could get enough victims to come forward with credible statements that were verifiable, and if they, without knowing each other, actually cross-corroborated each other, then that was something that sometimes made defendants just plead guilty so they wouldn't have to bring this child through that process. So that was my hope. But when we're saying this, I have to say that when we did our first hour on the Dr. Ford allegations, I said, I want to know, please tell me, are there other people who can corroborate this information?
Yes.
Are there other things like this? Now, unfortunately, it was broken up into two, and I didn't know. I didn't listen to the first half until after people were blowing up about it.
Right.
I didn't know. I never listened to the first half. I'm sorry. But after when I got the second half to review, I listened to that and realized that a lot of what I thought was in the first one
was actually not. Yeah.
But I said, look, I need people to tell me if they've experienced Brett Kavanaugh in this way, behavior consistent with that. Like, for example, we saw with Bill Cosby, where multiple people came forward, but not just victims of sexual assault, but multiple people came forward and talked about his personality, his behavior, how controlling he was, his bouts of rage, his extreme need to be in control, and the people that he had who basically were his fixers, who would pay off these women or keep them quiet. So all those things corroborated what the victims were saying.
And that's what was missing in this case
last week.
You and I recorded. And so let's finish up with Dr. Ford. And I just want to note that we are both looking forward to watching her testimony tomorrow and hearing her answer questions that we would both be asking her if she was sitting in our offices considering asking us to bring a prosecution or whether her case was, you know, going to be prosecuted. There are still inconsistencies in her story. I expect the prosecutor will be talking about. She has said various things about how many people were at the party in each of the different statements. The polygraph report, I want to touch briefly on that before we move on to Debbie Ramirez's allegations. But the polygraph report that has been provided now by Dr. Ford's attorneys and includes a written statement to her, which is the third version of the statement, one in a letter to Congress, one in this written statement for the polygraph, and then the third is her opening statement before Congress. All three of them have different configurations of people that were at the party,
right?
Which is what we call an internal inconsistency, and that is significant, bears on her credibility, and I want to hear her explanations for that.
Well, let's talk about that. Well, I mean, it's not unusual for somebody 36 years later to have inconsistencies like that.
Of course not.
It doesn't help her statement. It doesn't necessarily destroy her credibility.
No.
But if she has incredible details about other things and fails in those details, or if she remembers all those people being there, and then all of those people say they weren't there, that's where it's undermining her credibility.
Well, and that is what's happened. I know. Is that every single person that she's named as having been there, including the girl she says was her lifelong friend, deny the party ever took place. Her friend actually denies ever having met Brett Kavanaugh, meaning he wasn't at any party she was ever at. And so, again, there are a lot of questions that I hope will be answered tomorrow. But I wanted to talk quickly about the polygraph. Polygraphs are not generally admissible in court in this country. There's a reason for that. The FBI uses them. CIA uses them.
They're an investigative tool.
So they can be used, and I've certainly had them in some of my cases. But they're not admissible in court for a good reason, because they're not considered scientifically reliable enough to be admitted in a court of law. But what's more important to me about this is not the fact that she passed a polygraph, but the fact that this polygrapher, who was hired by either her or her team, this polygrapher only asked her two questions. And those questions were not, did Brett Kavanaugh attack you, or were you alone with Brett Kavanaugh, or anything Brett Kavanaugh related, but rather were simply two questions about the written statement that she had given him. Is this written statement false? Is anything in this written statement false? It doesn't make any sense.
No, that's not a proper way to do a polygraph.
That's not a proper polygraph. You and I both know.
First of all, there should be a pre-polygraph interview.
There was
no. And there should be a locked-in statement along with that.
Yes. Well, that was the supposed written statement.
And then the polygraph should be a number of questions. Two. I've just never heard one of two, but I guess whatever. But there's typically a number of questions and control questions.
That's right. There were no control questions, not a single control question, nothing to establish her baseline. So I just want people out there to know, while polygraphs are unscientific and therefore not admissible in court, this one was not even an attempt at being a real polygraph.
But the reason why is because there is a huge gap in the quality of the polygraphers.
Yes.
The training and the experience and the ability to read those polygraph results.
Because they have to be, quote, interpreted. That's what every good polygrapher will say. And I should say that this particular polygrapher is a retired FBI agent. I don't know if he was trained as a polygrapher in the FBI. I never learned.
Do you know
that.
What his name is?
Well, it's in their polygraph report. I don't have it right at my fingertips. But he is a former FBI person. But that is not the kind of polygraph that, in my opinion, is persuasive.
And it certainly is not up to the standards of an FBI polygraph.
No.
Did you guys know that most of us are brushing our teeth wrong? That's why I bought a Quip electric toothbrush, and I love it. Why a Quip electric toothbrush? Well, it's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes. It still packs just the right amount of vibration to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just for your convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including worldwide shipping. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip, including me. They were on Oprah's O-List. They were named one of Time's best inventions. And Quip is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Quip is backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers like me who use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/bestcase right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/bestcase, spelled getquip.com/bestcase.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So let's talk about corroboration. I have tried many cases where I had children or women whose word that they'd been sexually assaulted was all the evidence we had. In other words, not a single jot of physical evidence, no DNA, no fingerprints, no bruises, no nothing, just the word of the accuser, to use your term earlier, Jim, which is a good one. And what do we do about that? Well, in the past, we try to corroborate the child's statements, and that can be done in a million ways. You and I have talked before about Dylan Farrow's statements and the fact that they had indicators of veracity. But what I would try to do without that is to corroborate anything. On the day the child said they were assaulted last, was the actual offender at home? Was the time and place accurate? Did the child understand how far they might have been away from Christmas or the first day of school or a birthday? Did the child talk about the wallpaper on the wall or that the dishes were dirty that day? Anything that might corroborate the child. So here we have a woman making an allegation And last week we had no corroborating allegations. And this week now we've had two.
Several, actually.
But two that you and I have studied, at least, or at least looked over as of tonight. One of which is from a woman named Debbie Ramirez, who says that she was assaulted in the sense of having someone expose his penis to her when she was at Yale.
Let's break it down. So she said she was at a party. She got very drunk. She was on the floor. She was in and out. I mean, like blacking out. And she said somebody put their penis near her face and she reached out and pushed it away without wanting to. She didn't want to have contact with it. And then she remembers Brett Kavanaugh moving his hips forward as if he was lifting up his pants, pulling back up his pants. So she can't identify who actually did it, but she said right after that she saw Brett Kavanaugh doing what she thought was pulling up his pants. The problem with that is that in the week before she was to come out and make this statement that barely makes out any indication that Brett Kavanaugh did something wrong. The week before this, she was calling up her friends and telling them that she wasn't sure at all that it was Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, and did they remember who it was?
And she asked them. And nobody has recalled that it was him.
No.
And Brett Kavanaugh said he doesn't even know this woman, never met her, and was never at any such party or never did any such thing.
No.
And so, of course, people are asking, well, why would she make that up?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was very drunk. And I have been very drunk in my life. And you start spinning and you get sick and all sorts of things happen because alcohol is actually a poison. It's slightly killing you a little bit. And it's cutting off good oxygen and blood to your brain. And so you get sort of altered and you get your diminished capacity. And that's why it's hard to drive.
That's right.
She couldn't even stand up at this time. But that doesn't mean something didn't happen to her.
No, of course not. It doesn't mean that.
But it may very well mean that she doesn't know who did it.
That's right.
And that is not a credible statement.
No, and it has in common the first statement that people's names are given. These people are contacted as having been present when it happened, and none of them agree that it happened. And so it calls into question the credibility of these two accounts because of that.
And of course, when we see multiple accounts come out, we have to take that and say, well, cumulatively, this could be corroboration. But when each one taken separately has internal consistencies or lack of corroboration, then it cuts against the weight of that statement.
It does. And you can't, unfortunately, we can't take politics out of it. And so that brings us to the third account. We, I think, agree that there is corroboration lacking from each of the first two accounts, Dr. Ford and Debbie Ramirez. Again, doesn't mean they're lying, but we don't have any corroboration of what they said. Even the people they put forward do not corroborate their accounts. So that's problematic.
Right. And in the first case with Dr. Ford, there is enough detail, spatial relationships and so on and so forth, and affective information for me to say that that is some corroboration in the actual written statement, not what was reported about it.
Right.
You know, the word corralling was not in her statement.
No, it wasn't, but it was reported.
Pushed was the word that she used.
Mm-hmm.
And she also used the word groping.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so those are important details. All right, great. However, the fact that everybody she noted was at that party, every single person said they either didn't remember it or that didn't happen. And so that cuts against the credibility.
It does.
So we have to use that to weigh it. And then in Ramirez's statement, her admitted incapacity and the lack of an actual allegation that she could identify the person who did this. Unfortunately, there is no credible allegation against Brett Kavanaugh.
No, definitely not.
Because if there's no witness to it, admittedly on her part, there was more than one male in the room at the time.
That's right.
And she says that somebody put a penis in front of her and she pushed it away. But she did not see who that was attached to. And certainly there exists confusion about who did it.
Yes.
Because she was calling up people who she thought were there and telling them she wasn't sure who did it.
Right. And then suddenly, a couple of days later, she's sure it's Brett Kavanaugh, and they print it in the paper without any corroboration at all, and outright denials.
They get one person who said that he heard about it from somebody else, not anybody there, but from somebody else, that something like that happened. Well, that's way, way, way too weak to be called.
Well, it shouldn't have ever been printed in the paper, and you can't make allegations of sexual assault, which is what everyone's calling it, against Brett Kavanaugh when it's so poorly or non-existently corroborated. So that brings us to the third and, to me, most troubling allegation.
Of course. And you and I, when we heard this, we were very concerned.
Horrified.
Well, and then when we got to the details, I was actually much less horrified. And
yes,
that's a crazy statement, I know.
It
but
is
I was
a crazy
much
statement.
Less horrified because of the absurdity of this claim. And people are going to, you know, jump all over me or us for saying that. But the fact is that were this true, this means that many girls were raped many times. So there are dozens, at least, of victims, and maybe an equal number or greater number of offenders, and multiple gang rapes, and not a single report of this ever happened.
Well, no, Jim, it's so ridiculous, her statement, and I've gone over her statement as I would have as a prosecutor. I took notes today on every paragraph of her declaration, marking all the internal inconsistencies. And a couple of things stand out. First, let's just say for the, you know, two of you listening who don't know what we're talking about with this allegation, this Julie Swetnick has alleged that back in 1981 to 83, Brett Kavanaugh and his friend Mike Judge were effectively running rape gangs, were having parties all the time in that three-year period where girls were
on weekends,
even during the school year and in the summer, where girls were being routinely targeted, drugged, or plied with alcohol, then loaded somewhere into the house in a room where boys lined up outside to take turns raping them.
That's the allegation.
This is a ridiculously serious allegation. This is a horrifying event. And can I just say, first, right off the bat, I have prosecuted gang rape. Mm-hmm. I am by no means saying it does not exist. One of the top three most horrifying cases of my horrifying career was of a 13-year-old girl with the mental capacity of an 8-year-old who was gang raped by at least 25 men and boys.
Right. It's an episode of best case, worst case.
That's right.
And certainly
absolutely
your
right.
worst case
yes.
of your career. So absolutely, I totally understand that. Here's the thing. When you have a single gang rape, that is a major violent felony
yes.
with multiple offenders.
Yes.
That situation is very rare. To say that went on 10 times or dozens of times, and not a single person ever, not a family member, not a friend, nobody that this got bragged to about, none of these people ever reported that this was going on. This is a major crime. This is a major series of crimes. This is like saying that nobody would report a serial killer.
Jim, this is a multi-year, multi-offender, multi-victim criminal conspiracy allegation.
It's massive.
Massive.
It's a huge criminal allegation.
Yes.
And it sounds horrible.
Yes.
It sounds
shocking.
Horrible
it's
for
shocking.
Brett Kavanaugh, for Mr. Judge, and for a number of other people. Let's just drill down for a second into the details of this allegation. So, what Ms. Swetnick says is that she graduated from Gaithersburg High School in Gaithersburg, Maryland, What she fails to say is that she did so in 1980.
Yeah, and Jim, don't you find it significant that she failed to put that date in her supposedly sworn statement?
Yes, I do. Because she says she first met Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge in 1980, 81 approximately. So what she's saying is she is a senior in high school graduating when Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge are sophomores.
Well, in 80, yeah, they would have been exactly sophomores. Yes. Exactly.
She's
right.
A senior.
Yes.
In high school when they are sophomores.
Yes.
She is 18 when they are 16.
Yes.
That these 16-year-olds somehow were masterminds of this huge criminal rape conspiracy that they pulled off over the course of a number of years.
Three.
And nobody ever reported it to law enforcement or the schools or any parents of any of
any
these victims.
Older sibling?
No girl came home after being raped by multiple teenage boys and ever got taken to the doctor or was examined by their parent or whatever. And this came out. None of that ever happened.
No. It's strange credulity.
Yes, it does. And then what Ms. Swetnick says is that this went on from 81 to 83. 81 to 83.
Yes.
She was out of high school in 80. So in 81, 82, and 83, she was either in college or just a high school graduate. But she went on to get degrees, so she was most likely in college at this time.
She was like 20.
So she's going back at 19, 20, and 21 mm-hmm. to parties that were being thrown by high school kids.
Yes.
And she says in this document, that she found out that they were drugging the punch. So what did she do? She continued to go to the parties, but avoided the punch.
And just watched other girls drink the punch and get raped.
Apparently, that's according to her statement.
It's ridiculous.
And then she says, and I feel really sorry for her if this happened to her, that in 1982, she was gang raped.
At one of these parties, yes. That's what she says.
At one of these parties where Judge and Kavanaugh were present.
Yes, she says they were present. She certainly doesn't claim they raped her.
Right. She specifically does not say that. Why? Why? She has all this information about how bad Brett Kavanaugh is and how he and Judge organized these parties and drugged these women.
And targeted these women and stood outside the door. She says she has a specific memory of the two of them standing outside the door in line waiting their turn to rape one of these girls. That, by the way, at 18, 19, and 20, it never seemed to occur to her to put a stop to rescue or call the police about. Absurd.
Yeah, and that is a difference. This is in 1981 and in 1982, before she was raped, she was not a victim.
No.
And this is not a victim not wanting to disclose. This is a adult woman.
That's right.
Not disclosing that teenage girls are being raped by these other guys.
Every weekend by gangs, organized gangs of boys.
Multiple
parties.
Guys.
That's right.
I find that incredible. Not credible at all.
No, not even a little.
And the fact that she says she continued to go back to these parties knowing that this was what was going on. Absurd. Absolutely absurd. What was the draw for her to go to these parties? What was it? I want to know. I would love to get an opportunity to interview this woman.
Yes.
But I am, you can probably hear it in my voice, I am angry.
Me too.
That this kind of outrageous allegation was brought forward by a, quote, attorney at law. Outrageous. In and of itself, it smacks of complete and total bullshit. And I will call it bullshit. There's nothing in this complaint at all that is truthful, up into and including the fact that she says she's swearing to it under the penalty of perjury. Because let me tell you something. There is no penalty of perjury when you fill out an affidavit like this and sign it.
It's not an affidavit.
No.
She didn't swear to anything.
She didn't do it in front of a court or even a notary public.
No, it's ridiculous.
It's just outrageous. And I know she didn't do that because her signature is on this. And there is no seal. There's nothing. So it can't be that she did it later because, I'm sorry, you have to do that in front of the person you're That's swearing right. it to.
And people say, and I've heard them say all over the news, you can tell Jim and I are outraged because we've prosecuted actual crimes similar to gang rapes or gang yes. rapes themselves with actual victims. And this gives every victim a much harder road when they themselves come forward with an allegation. This case will be held up as the standard of it probably is false. And so their allegation is false. It is utterly outrageous from start to finish, from line one to line end. It is maddening that she says these things, incredible that an attorney would bring this forward and that it would come before the public and that anyone would give it credence. And I saw a former federal prosecutor being interviewed on an online show saying that she found this statement to be credible. That is clearly someone off her rocker.
Okay. And let me just tell you something. They make great pains of saying that she had also previously held the following inactive clearances: Secret, U.S. Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection, all these things, her prior employment. Look, I want to tell you something. The fact that she got security clearances doesn't surprise me. She's a graduate of high school. Apparently, she went to college. She could be a very incredibly accomplished professional. Mm-hmm. That has nothing to do with what follows in this very affidavit. It's so absurd that if it wasn't an allegation of gang rape, which I take very seriously and you take very seriously, mm-hmm. organized gang rape over the course of 3 years by high school kids, mm-hmm. high school kids. Has it ever happened that high school kids have gang raped somebody?
Yes, absolutely.
And we know about them.
We do. We know about them.
We know about them.
That's the point. We know
because
about them.
They come out. It was a horrific case of a girl who was drugged by her boyfriend, and then he dragged her around to a whole bunch of parties and football players had sex with her, and it was covered up. But it was known, and it came out.
That's right.
If this happened in 1981 and 1982 and 1983 in this very wealthy suburb of Washington, D.C., in a very strict Catholic school environment, if this was done by these teenagers, they would have to be incredibly criminally sophisticated, incredibly forensically sophisticated, and incredibly capable of controlling the behavior of everyone around them in order for this to have been kept quiet. This is a mega crime. This is not just a sexual assault. This is a mega crime.
It's a criminal conspiracy.
And yeah, but people, that doesn't even scratch the surface of how friggin' huge this crime is. These multiple crimes, these repeat serial offender crimes.
For 3 years. But Jim, there's one other thing too. It's not just that no one in the community knew about it. It's not that they kept it hundreds of victims or at least dozens of victims, dozens of offenders over 3 years, kept it a secret. They also kept it a secret from the FBI, who did no less than 6 national security background checks on Brett Kavanaugh. And they asked questions on these kind of background checks, like, did this person ever do anything that might make them open to blackmail? Or did they ever advocate for the overthrow of the United States government? Or would you trust them? You're telling me that the FBI 6 different times goes all the way back in Kavanaugh's background to friends and family, and there's not a hint, not a whisper.
But it's not just friends and family. What happens when you put in your application, when you fill out your background questionnaire, you list every place you ever lived, every member of your family, every place you ever worked, every place you ever traveled.
It's exhausting.
And you have to put references for each of those things.
Yes, there has to be someone there for them to talk to at each place.
And they then go to those people and they ask them for references.
Yes.
And you know what they do next? They take each one of those references and they ask them for references. So they're now not talking to the people that Brett Kavanaugh wanted them to talk to, or not talking to the people that Brett Kavanaugh's references wanted them to talk to. They're talking to another layer of people that Brett Kavanaugh could have no control over.
No.
And they find out from these people what kind of person, what's their character. They don't just ask them, you know, simple, do you know him to commit this crime or that crime? No. They ask them questions about their integrity, their trustworthiness.
Yes.
And there's plenty of opportunities over the course of those six background investigations for people to have come forward and said something about this without it getting back to them.
Yeah. And the other thing is, this is kind of a small thing, but I was thinking about this today. Jim, you know how sometimes criminal conspiracies or otherwise hidden crimes come to light. And that is when one of the perpetrators gets arrested for something unrelated. Mm-hmm. They get arrested or get in trouble for something. And in order to try to get out of that trouble, they have an ace card, right, in their back pocket.
Right.
They can play the, hey, by the way, I know about this massive gang rape train conspiracy that was taking place in a wealthy suburb of D.C., 81 to 83. And the fact that that has also never happened, or that any of these rapists have never been charged with another sexual offense.
Right. So here,
beggars belief.
Right. Here are 16, 17, and 18-year-old boys. Well, when they're 18, they become young men, doing multiple rapes over the course of multiple years, and not a single one of them was ever arrested or never went on to continue to rape people. Where did this happen? How did this happen in a vacuum and get sealed up so tight? How did it go away?
It never happened. That's the explanation. It actually never happened.
That's the only credible explanation I could find.
It is.
Now, all that said, that doesn't mean that Julie Swetnick wasn't raped.
No,
that Julie Swetnick wasn't the victim of gang rape. That very much could have happened. But I do not believe that that happened under these circumstances. And I believe that the incredible reach that this document tries to attain by drawing in Brett Kavanaugh through this guy Judge and other unknown named people is outrageous. And I believe that the attorney had a responsibility to not put this out in the public. And I believe that that attorney, as credible as any allegation any of his other clients has ever made, has undermined all of them by putting this out.
Well, and he hasn't just undermined all of his clients, Jim. What he's done is undermined, to the extent it wasn't already, undermined the credibility of Debbie Ramirez and Christine Ford. Because what this looks like is a political hit, or a hit based on some kind of hatred of either Kavanaugh or the president or both, or just the party that's in power at this time. And so it draws into question the whole thing. And what it also does is question the credibility of any allegations that will now drop. And we've started to hear a couple more start to cycle through as we came in here to record. I haven't had a chance to really review them, but I'm not even sure they matter, because these allegations look like piling on to someone to bring him down and not report true occurrences. And because of that, you've got the process of the confirmation of a potential judge of the United States Supreme Court hanging in the balance. There's a lot of power associated with it. There are a lot of entrenched interests. You've got presidential elections coming up and congressional midterms. There's so much political baggage here that is causing everyone to go wild.
I agree. And just as we were coming in here, I read an allegation from a woman that said that Brett Kavanaugh assaulted her in 1995, which is smack in the middle of the time that I was working with Brett Kavanaugh as an FBI agent on the independent counsel that Ken Starr ran against the Clintons. And during that time period, I spent many long days and long nights working with Brett Kavanaugh. And during that time period, we did go out to dinner and we did have drinks and we did work long into the night and we did hang out sometimes, because I didn't know anybody else. I was out of my city where I grew up, where I lived. And so I mainly socialized with the other people from the independent counsel's office. And Brett Kavanaugh was one of them. And I can state unequivocally that during that time period, I never witnessed him get drunk, first of all, and two, when he was drinking, I never witnessed any kind of change in his personality. That doesn't mean it can't happen, but I'm telling you because I witnessed it. I'm giving our listeners my perspective. I told people right from the start, I know him. I respect him as a human being. I respect him as a judge. I respected him as a lawyer. So I can't say that I am unbiased in this.
And you said that last time, by the way.
I did. Of course I did. Of course I did.
You did.
On top of that, I would not be able to testify or to even investigate Brett Kavanaugh because I would have to recuse myself because there's personal knowledge there. I said that right up front. But what I believe the value I can bring is actually share with you. I have over 30 years of experience as a criminal investigator and prosecutor. I have tons more experience doing this than the vast majority of law enforcement officers in the United States of America or around the world.
Very true.
So I want to give people my perspective because I think it will help them. Help them not be so upset that somebody like a rapist was going to be on the Supreme Court. I don't know if he's going to get confirmed or not. And as I said before, my politics are very different than his.
Very different.
They're very different than yours.
Yes.
But what we remain on the same side of is justice. We want justice. If the allegations against Brett Kavanaugh were credible, we would be screaming about them.
Yes.
As much as we're screaming about this outrageous crap from this affidavit that came out today.
Yes.
The fact is, there is no credibility in that. There is some credibility in Dr. Ford's statement. There is too much unknown in Debbie Ramirez's statement. And there certainly is no credible allegation against Brett Kavanaugh in that statement because it was undermined by her calls to her friends the week before.
Yes.
Over the week before.
Yes.
So we're left with a very disturbing situation. Are people ganging up on him because of political agendas? Are people ganging up on him because they just want to blindly listen to every possible victim? Unfortunately, both of those things have extremely negative consequences, not only for Brett Kavanaugh, but for victims of crime.
Yes. That's what bothers me the most.
I've been the victim of crime a number of times in my life. You've been the victim of crime. Most people have. I want to be believed when I report a crime. I don't want to have to be cross-examined on what's on this outrageous declaration. I don't want people to disbelieve women who are raped, children who are raped, boys who are raped, men who are raped. I don't want that to happen. But this is fantasy. 100% pure fantasy, what's in this document. I'm not saying she's lying about her victimization. What I'm saying is this statement cannot be corroborated. Every attempt at corroborating it has fallen through 100%. No one has corroborated anything that she says in this statement. And the facts are just too outrageous to be true and still remain hidden.
And that's the Julie Swetnick statement, everybody. You can't see, but Jim's pointing at it. I just want to make that clear. He's talking about Julie Swetnick's statement. And Jim, that is my biggest concern here, is that you'll have true victims coming forward and not being believed, or deciding not to come forward because they might not be believed. Whenever you have a Duke lacrosse case or a UVA fraternity false allegation case, or this Julie Swetnick with this outrageous and completely uncreditable account of Kavanaugh and his teenage friends engaging in sophisticated criminal conspiracy for 3 years. I know, it's absurd.
16 years old when they hatched this plan and were able to
execute
it perfectly and make it go on for years and nobody ever heard about it or brought them to justice.
It's crazy.
And it's outrageous. I'm not talking about Julie Swetnick, the possible victim of rape. I'm talking about Julie Swetnick, the adult witness to the rape of teenage girls, remaining silent. That is not something that happens.
I don't believe it.
When people who are adults witness children being raped or sexually assaulted, generally, they step in to help that child. They report it and they try to stop it. This woman with all these security clearances, this woman with experience from all these government agencies did not help girls.
For 3 years. So I don't believe it. So this episode of best case, worst case scenario has gone longer than normal, but because of the topic, because of our passion, because of your passion, listeners, in writing into us, and we do appreciate everyone listening. We don't appreciate the insults, but we certainly appreciate you writing in, even when you disagree, but be prepared. People seem to take offense when I then defend our position. Be prepared for us to defend our position. We may disagree with you, but that doesn't mean we're going to be disrespectful.
Not at all. And you could see, I mean, we weren't being disrespectful, but we did call out people who were being very disrespectful to us.
Yes.
We will continue to listen. For us, it'll be tomorrow. When we drop this episode, it might have been yesterday, when Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford actually testified in a hearing in front of the Senate. We will learn more.
Yes.
And we will take that in and we will continue to evaluate it.
And talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And post about it.
But we will not ever discount people and what they say just because they're women or just because they're kids or just because they're boys or just because they're girls or just because they're men. And so everyone should understand that we're doing that because that is what the law demands. That is what the law demands. Equality. Not believing one person over another because of their gender. Not believing one person over another because of their position, because of their race, or because of their religion.
Or wealth.
Or political party. None of that matters. What matters is what actually happened. And what Francie and I are trying to do is get down to the truth of the matter. We are doing our best to evaluate this information as it comes out. And it comes out in dribs and drabs. And as you've seen, it comes out misrepresented and misinterpreted. And we're trying to clear up those misrepresentations and those misinterpretations. We're trying to give you the benefit of our combined 50 plus years of experience in law enforcement and in the justice system. We hope that we've added to this dialogue. And yes, I admit, I get very emotional when I talk about things like gang rape and teenagers being raped in front of adults who do nothing. That is absolutely never acceptable. Unless your life has been threatened, if you as an adult witness a child being raped, it is your obligation. I don't care who you are, male, female, whatever. It is your obligation to report that and to stop it from happening, not to continue to attend parties where this is going on. It's outrageous. What kind of person are you?
100% agree, Jim. What kind of person is she? I hope we've added to the debate a little and answered some of your questions. We'll continue to do so. But for now, for best case, worst case scenario, we're signing off. Thanks for listening.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Stories about child sexual abuse can make us feel powerless. But the good news is that there are organizations working to prevent abuse and keep kids safe. Darkness to Light and their Stewards of Children prevention training has trained more than 1.4 million adults to protect, recognize, and react responsibly to child sexual abuse.
But there's more work to do. And with their 4 million by 2020 goal, Darkness to Light is setting their sights on training 4 million adults around the country to keep kids safe. By donating to Darkness to Light, you can help reach this goal that will make communities across the country safer places for kids.
It starts with you. Visit www.d2l.org today to give. That's www.d2l.org.